This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is Frida Liu. You're listening to Raise Your Game. Lots of exciting things happening in the studio today. Most importantly, we've got Shankar Sandeep from EQTD Consulting.
That has to be the most exciting thing.
Of course, this is our Success Consciousness series, and we're going to talk about a hope-filled attitude can fuel success. I need hope right now.
You do?
In this studio.
Right.
Now, along the way, of course, if you have any questions for us, you can WhatsApp us at 0162019000, tweet us at BFM Radio, and also if you go to our BFM Enterprise Facebook page, we're live there, and you can ask your questions there as well. So tell us, what is your attitude towards hope? I need it now.
I don't know, Frida, are you hope-filled?
Am I hope-filled? Mm. I am generally very hope-filled kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I like hanging out with you.
True.
Yeah, I think with the coaching sessions that I do, often, right, I find so many people have a problem with hope, you know. They spend a lot of time talking to me about how disengaged they feel and how disconnected they are with their jobs. You know, this is a big problem. But at the same time, they also talk to me about the fact that I have great dreams. I want to do this with my life. I'd like to become this, or I have all these fantastic ideas that I want. Mm. And it always, I feel incumbent upon myself when I meet my coaches to tell them that in my experience, it's really impossible to achieve any measure of success if you don't have hope. If you walk around feeling hopeless, that becomes a problem. Now, years ago, when I was still living in England as a young, just finished my education, and I was working there for a couple of years before I came back home, I found that as life takes its course along the way, you realize that the spring in your step every day when you get up in the morning is very much determined by what's happening to you at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to stay on in England at that time, and I had a life and a lifestyle which I was happy with. But like everything else, the authorities play a very large role in what happens to everyone. I found that I was working, but my visa was going to expire. And as I was trying to get myself a new visa to stay on as a student or as whatever else at the time, it was very difficult. And at the original stages, when I was trying to do this, I was all excited about it. You know, I wanted to do it. So I thought, oh, yeah, I'm going to go. I'm going to apply. I'm going to do this, going to do that, going to do this. Whereas as every avenue closed, and this is not possible, and that is not, I found it really hard to wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, go out. I would work. I would do things. I'd come back. I would hang out with my friends, and then I would go to sleep really late and never get up in the morning. I'd emerge at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And I realized after a while that this thing was becoming a real bad habit, that I was just sleeping through the day and going out at night and, you know, engaging in activities which were not that productive for me, consuming all sorts of things that were not going to help me become better as well. And as I was trying to figure out what it was, I had people who said, I think you're in a depression. I think you're in this or you're in that. You know, people have all manner of...
in a state of funk.
Yeah, in a state of funk. You've lost your mojo. Everyone is a pseudo-psychologist and gives you an idea. All your friends always tell you what's going on. But I realized at the end of the day, it was simply because there was a dearth of hope. You know, because I felt a certain sense of hopelessness that I found it very hard to wake up in the morning to do things. And that's why I ask people, are you filled with hope? Because if you really want to, you know, achieve any measure of success in your life, you have to actually be a hope-filled and a hope-fueled person.
Okay. And how did you get it? I mean, how did you get this hope going on? I mean, and I think, like, let's just connect it back to the workplace, right?
Yeah.
And how some people are disconnected with their work.
Yeah.
Is it because they're not hope-filled?
Very interesting. In all my career so far as a trainer, as a training consultant, and as a leadership coach, as well as a management consultant, I get to meet a lot of entrepreneurs. I get to meet a lot of people who do very well in their businesses and who are, you know, over the last 5-10 years, I've met a lot of startups. I work with the startup industry with MDEC and Magic and places like this. I have yet to find a CEO or a leader or a managing director of a a new company who is downtrodden.
Okay.
You know, no matter how dramatically no money, the no money situation is, while they may be distraught, they're not downtrodden.
Okay.
You know, there is a huge difference between worrying about the fact that, oh my God, I can't pay my bills this month and I need to do this and I need to do that. I have never met a single one of these people who are just, there's no hope. My business is hopeless.
Mm.
You know, they never do that. Even at the point, and I've also met them when they want to close their businesses and move on to something else. Even at that point, they're not hopeless.
Right.
It's very interesting that people who achieve any measure of success have a certain amount of hope. And what do we mean by hope? There's something that you're looking forward to. Mm. There's something that fuels your passion. There's something that that you want, that you're willing to extend yourself for.
Mm.
Something that keeps you going forward. You know, fear, for example, is a common denominator in all of us. Fear and defeat is a common denominator in all of us. We've all been defeated one way or the other at some point in our life. How we respond to defeat is very much predicated on your mental make.
Yeah.
And your mental make, a mental make which is based on hope, is a mental make that will actually turn defeat from something that debilitates to something that motivates. You know, and I think that's the cycle that we're looking for all the time.
What's that song? I get knocked down, but I get up
again. I get knocked down, but I get up again.
And it's very interesting what you said, distraught, but not downtrodden.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a great English lesson here today.
Well, it is, in the sense that, you're saying I'm a good English teacher. Distraught. I mean, we all become distraught. I mean, you know, there are times when we get really upset about stuff.
Yeah.
There's no escaping that because we are emotional beings. I mean, we're organic, you know, therefore we have issues. All of us. And sometimes those issues are inexplicable in the sense that, you know, you meet someone for the first time and you think, wow, I feel like I've known them for all my life.
Mm.
You meet someone else for the first time and they have a face you want to slap. You have no idea why. Nobody can really explain this. You know what I'm saying, Frida? So, yeah. I mean, there's so much of life which is not explainable. And a lot of it I put down to the fact that we are organic, you know, and that we are emotional.
And there's always hope in everything, right?
I mean, There has to be hope in everything.
Yeah. And you think, like, when all else fails, right? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I want to see my son grow up to be a wonderful young man.
Absolutely.
And there's hope, right? And then you just find things to work.
We are, I think as human beings, we only have two options in life. Either you are problem-oriented or solution-oriented. You and I know what being problem-oriented means, which simply means that you wallow in your problem. So we have problems.
And you only look for problems.
Or problems seem to end up coming in your direction all the time.
Are we talking about the same person?
We know people who are like this. This is not, I'm afraid, it's not an inside joke, but really you and I both know people who are like this, who just covet problems. You know, they're like a magnet for problems.
Mm.
And their life is, you know, laden with problems. And then you have others who, you think, seemingly they coast through life. In fact, they're not coasting through life.
There's this visual picture of that swan, right?
Yeah.
And they're just paddling, or a duck, and they're just paddling underneath, but they know.
And successful people, I find, when I use the word successful people, I use it very, very generically.
Mm.
And my definition of successful people is people I meet along the way with the work that I do who have achieved some measure of greatness or some measure of success, both financially or in terms of managing people or in terms of growing their businesses. That's what I look at success. That's how I look at success. And successful people, I find, seem to be able to tap into some reserves of hope to re-energize themselves whenever something goes wrong.
Mm.
You know, and that's the interesting part of this whole exercise then. If these people can do it, I'm always curious why some people can do some things and others can't. And as we go along, I think we are all the same. It's just that we make choices in life. It's to how we want to respond to things.
Okay. You know, you said something early on about, working, you know, they may... money, right? Let's just bring up money. Does money encourage people to work harder? Or is that going to give me hope?
Well, it's a very interesting... question whether money actually, you know, I'm still in two minds about this, to be honest. Yes and no. I'd say yes and no. Let's start off with a no. Let's get rid of this negative, right? For example, I recently had discussion with a coachee of mine who was a senior manager in I can't name their company, but they are arguably Malaysia's most successful government linked organization, okay. GLC, biggest, most successful GLC in Malaysia, and they pay their staff phenomenal amounts of money, pay a lot of money. That's one of the reasons why they are able to attract some of the best brains in the country. He was a senior manager, and he was having some difficulty managing his team, and he came to me for me to help him. And I was curious to find out whether these people, because they were getting paid so much money, were far more encouraged to work harder or to do better. And he looked at me and said, "No, I have the same problem with this team that I had with the team that I worked in a different company with, where they didn't pay the same amount of money." So that particular model where you get paid more money, you tend to work better, I think that doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
The law of diminishing returns.
Absolutely. Money is not the sole stimulus for high performance. I think it is one of the things that are important to... You know, in 2002, and I think we did this some years ago, we did a full 15-episode roundtable, you know, that went on for more than a year, Frida, where we had... I brought a lot of interesting people as guests along with me, right? In 2002, the Australian Business Council went to the University of Sydney and said, please go and do some research and find out and let us know what makes an excellent workplace. What makes an excellent workplace? And when we look at what makes an excellent workplace, distribute it down, give us the drivers, and tell us how we can duplicate this and pass it on to all our other council members, our members. So the University of Sydney went, picked 8 industries, the best bank, top of class. So best bank, best hospital, best education institution, etc., broadcast and so on, went and spent quite a long time, inside 6 months to 8 months, in each of these places to actually go through the systems and processes to find out why these were excellent workplaces. At the end of that year, the end of 2002, they produced this paper and they came up and said, these are the 15 drivers that make an excellent workplace, 1 to 15. And they categorized them and they put them in a hierarchy of 1 to 15. 1 being the best, 15 being the least important, but all 15 being important as a whole. The reason I'm bringing this up, money was one of the 15. So money is an important part. It's an important motivator, but it is not the most important motivator. Money came out at number 8, which is smack in the middle of 15.
Right.
You know, and the things that came out before money were, number 1, the quality of workplace relationships, which is the most important aspect of making an excellent workplace. So if you come into BFM and you like the people that you work with, you don't think they're idiots and they don't have faces you want to slap, right? You will be happy. And that means you will have a spring in your step and hope you'll be hopeful when you come into work. The second thing is the quality of leadership. The leadership that we all require is the leadership that will give us clear direction, will not be dithering around, will not take sides, and there's some clarity. When you look at them, go like, yeah, I know I need to behave in this particular way, and my leaders will hold my hand and take me forward. The third one is having a say. You want to work in an organization where you can... you have a space to voice your opinion. In Bahasa Malaysia, they say ruang untuk bersuara. You know what I mean? Give me some space to speak, man. Don't cut me down all the time. And I don't want to feel like if I open my mouth and say the wrong thing, I might lose my job. You know, so on and so forth. These are the types of things, right? So money, to answer your question, money is important, but not the sole motivator in getting people to become hopeful.
Right. This is the Success Consciousness series together with Ashanga Santir from EQTD Consulting. We're talking about hopeful attitude and how that can fuel success. Stay tuned to Raise It Game, BFM 89.9.
Bold Factual Media, BFM 89.9.
This is Enterprise and Raise Your Game. Shankar Santiram from EQTD Consulting here in our Success Consciousness series. And today we're talking about hope-filled attitude and how this can fuel success. If you have any questions so far, you can always WhatsApp us at 0162019000. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Join us on our BFM Enterprise Facebook page. We're live there. Yes, that's him waving, looking all bright and chirpy. You spring in a step.
I have a spring in my step this morning.
So, you know, just early on, we were talking about, you know, does money encourage people to work harder? And according to that study that you were referring to, number 8 out of 15, right in the middle. You need it. You know, you can't take it out, that's for sure. But
money is not a bad word. Money is not bad. It's not a bad word. It's perfectly fine.
Okay. Now, before we go, whether money is a big motivator for you, I've got Zahid Nayan asking us this question. What if my ambitions are big and I have a long way to go? How do I not lose hope? So I have a long way to go.
Yeah.
How do I not lose hope?
Well, all of us, I think, Zahid, all of us have ambitions. And some of our ambitions are easily graspable and some require consistent effort. It's like someone saying, I want to be a doctor. That's my dream. That's my wish. And I'm quite clear why. Always fall back on purpose. If you know why you want to do something, then it will motivate you. For example, if you smoke, and that's a big problem for a lot of people. If you ask any smoker, is this bad for you? Not a single rational smoker, and I know a lot of rational smokers, I was a rational smoker myself, will say that no, it's not bad for you. It's fantastic. It's a vitamin. You know, in fact, it gives a spring in my step. You know, I think every smoker will tell you that. Yeah, we know it's killing us one way or the other, but we can't stop because it is an addiction. Because nicotine has an addictive component in it that keeps you wanting it all the time. Therefore, you carry on. However, if you have a catastrophic experience along the way. For example, I always use this in all my training programs, that if you have a heart attack tonight, you will wake up tomorrow morning and stop smoking. And I can attest to this. This is really, I've met many, many people who stop immediately after they have a catastrophic experience like this. You know? Why is it? Because I think at that point when they fall ill or when something, some catastrophe happens to them, their purpose gets realigned almost instantly.
When you have your life flashing
That's
before
right.
your eyes.
So your purpose goes boom, you know, in front of you. And then you go like, right, clear, no problem, I can stop. So similarly, if you have long-term ambitions, firstly, be very clear that you need to be sure why you want to do that side. It's important, you know. So it's like not just, oh, I have this ambition. And then you think that I want to go down this road. If that ambition is not strong enough, if it's not purpose-fueled, purpose-driven, and purpose-laden, what happens is you'll get waylaid along the way. You'll just go like, let's see how it goes. How do you not lose hope? Be clear with purpose. And then make sure that that particular ambition that you have energizes you, makes you feel like, you know, good, makes you feel like it's something worthy for you to get to. You know? And if it's something worthy for you to get to, you're happy to do it. You know? Frida, you know I go regularly, maybe twice a year, sometimes more than that, to watch Manchester United play for, you know, at Old Trafford. And
you
I know
a conversation for 7 p.m. Anyway.
But I'm just giving you an example. Yeah. Now, this is an ambition. It's an ambition I had years and years ago when I was much younger. And I tied it down to the fact that if I could afford to do that, that means my career is going well.
Uh-huh.
All right? So I knew that if I could actually afford to buy 2 tickets to go or 1 ticket to go twice a year or 3 times a year, that just meant I had extra money.
Right.
And if I had extra money, that meant that I was doing fairly well financially in order to be able to pay all my bills, do all my stuff and still do this. Yeah. So whilst everyone I know makes a lot of fun about the fact that I go and I've been there 27 times now to watch Manchester United play, I do it again and again because it is an ambition that keeps me hopeful all the time.
Right.
Right. So if your ambition also, it's not just that the hope needs to keep you going. Your ambition will keep your hope going as well. It's a cyclical process.
In a way, it's you see the reward. What's the reward at the end of
Absolutely.
It, right? I mean, I've got a simple thing that I say, I want to see 2 new countries a year.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So to be able to do
and
that.
And how compelling is that reason for
right?
you?
Right? Yeah? It's got to be really compelling.
Yeah.
So
and
what
if
do
it
I
is?
Need to do to get to that, right?
What?
And it's, you know, you got to work harder, you got to do...
You got to do all of that, but most importantly, you need to have that image of those 2 countries at the beginning of the year, and those 2 images need to be compelling. Every time you think about it, every time you feel a bit down, and you don't take on a new job, for example, or you get some job that comes along the way, and you say, I'm feeling a bit lazy, I don't feel like doing this, I'm feeling a bit lazy and I don't feel like doing this, for example, you will then get up and do it because you go like, you know, no, I know I'm feeling a bit meh, I don't feel like working at the moment. But then you think of, I don't know, Suriname, which is the country that you wanted to go to in South America, or the Cayman Islands, or something like that. And then you go like,
you know what?
I have no problem going to work today because, you know, this is going to pay for the flight towards the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, and I guess also the other thing is, like, I know you've got this long ambition there. Maybe it's taking a while. You do little things that actually sort of get you there. Yeah. And small successes, small wins, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
Small wins to get to the big goal and all that.
Absolutely.
We have another question, and this is from Ganesh Nair. I think I know that guy. He says, does losing hope mean that you have to believe in your abilities? Does having hope mean that you have to believe in your abilities?
Does having hope, why would you lose hope?
Does having hope mean that you have to believe in your abilities?
Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously,
absolutely.
Right?
100%. You have to believe in your abilities. You must have self-efficacy. Mm. It's important to have self-efficacy. Self-efficacy simply means that you back yourself to do certain things. Like, I went for a meeting a couple of weeks ago. Third largest bank in Malaysia. Met the chief operating officer, COO. He laid out his range of problems for his organization. And I listened to that whole thing, and 50%, 60% of what he had, what he laid out to me, I could almost instantly grasp and go like, okay, I have a solution for that, for this, for that. This is something I've been doing before. There are about two or three things that he asked me, which really kind of floored me, Frida. You know, I was just like, I'm not sure how to do this. But self-efficacy meant, I thought to myself, you know what, I kind of know what he wants. I just don't know how to articulate and explain this to him right now. I told him, leave it with me. I'll get it sorted out for you. I'll send a proposal out to you within the next 24, 48 hours, and we will have that plan. I went back home, went back to the office, I sat through, went through with my team exactly what that problem was. We workshopped it in the office, went through other things that we did for other customers and saw whether there were any similarities. We put it together, we put the proposal through, and we are running a program for them in a couple of weeks.
Right.
So they've been, that was, you know, from a business point of view, from a marketing point of view, it was a sale.
Mm.
We made a sale, you know, a fairly large sale, a five-figure sale, you know what I mean? And this is purely based on believing in our abilities, not just my ability as an individual, but my entire team's ability. So yes,
okay.
You know, being hopeful means always having that ability.
All right. Okay. Now, so the question is, you know, we were talking about money early on. And it's a number eight. So is money a big motivator for you? Is it a number eight for you?
Well, you know how I look. Honest, straightforward answer is money is important to me.
Yeah.
Money is important to me. It is not the most important thing in my life, right? Mm. But I look at money I look at money as an enabler. I look at money as an enabler for a whole range of other things that I do. Over the last 18 months or so, my own family, we've had some difficulties, some tragedies. My father's brother, one brother had cancer, quite severe. Another brother passed away very, very suddenly in Australia, in the Gold Coast, and his insurance didn't want to pay for the repatriation of the body and stuff like that. And the family got into a bit of a state of panic because it was going to cost a huge amount of money. I was well-placed to tell the family, listen, just let's pool our resources together. And whatever that we don't have, I'll top it up. And the amounts were quite substantive, you know, to actually repatriate this my uncle, to help another uncle with his treatment. And so, look at, so now, how am I able to do that? You know, why am I able to do that? People came to me and said, you're such a kind person. You're so good. No, well done. Help. Thank you for helping the family. Money is an enabler.
Hmm.
And it motivates me. See that feeling that I am able to help my family? Not just my immediate family, but my extended family.
Right.
That feeling that I can help my extended family is the great motivator.
Right.
Money on its own is not the motivator. But I do appreciate and understand that I need that money to be able to do these types of things, you know. Earning 10,000 ringgit as a salary or 20,000 ringgit as a salary in itself may not be very inspiring, you know. But the idea, but being connected with the idea of the type of lifestyle this will generate must actually help you. I believe that connecting in money also is, in essence, linked to hope. We talked about hope. We're talking about hope. This whole idea that money is an enabler, it's again linked with hope, hopefulness. Mm-hmm. You feel hope, you know, when this happens. There's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk called, Vietnamese names are so hard to pronounce, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Oh, yeah,
With all sorts of other little bits and yeah. boxes, little squiggly prawny bits here and there. Thich Nhat Hanh. Could be Thich Nhat Hanh. You know, a Vietnamese monk, was a peace activist and an author, once said, hope is important because it makes the present moment less difficult to bear. Yeah. If we believe that tomorrow will be better, we can actually bear hardship today. This is actually very interesting. Isn't that what we are taught from a young age? Old school parenting. What did our folks tell us? Study hard now so that your future will be bright. No, you and I were, ding-dongs. We didn't do it.
We've got more questions, and then we'll talk about that in just a moment. Shaka Santir from EQTD Consulting here in our Success Consciousness series. Stay tuned to Race Again after the Bursa update. BFM 89.9.
Bazaar Football Money. BFM 89.9.
Yeah, we're talking about money. You're listening to Raise Your Game. This is Frida Leo, Shankar Santiram from EQTD Consulting in our Success Consciousness series. We talk about hope-filled attitude and how that can fuel success. We've got a question here from Barry Evans. Hi, Barry. I said, is there a difference between hope and mojo? Well, mojo was coined by Austin Powers. I've lost my mojo. And of course, you can share the 15 keys on Facebook as
hope
well.
And mojo, I mean, you know, yes, I think there's some correlation between hope and mojo. I'm sure Austin Powers would agree with me. But let's start off with an understanding of what mojo means. Mojo is a little, I don't know, what is it? Something special that you have, a little kind of spark that you have that you can look at a problem and then, you know, that spark will help you determine whether you're doing right or wrong. I think there's a little bit of magic in the word mojo. Hope, on the other hand, is not magic-based. It's actually emotion-based more than anything else. You know. Hope is when you have something to look forward to, when you can do the most difficult things in your day-to-day, mundane, routine, rigmarole, and then feel that, yes, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this properly, even though it is arguably the most boring thing in my life right now. I'll do it because it's necessary, because if I finish doing this, then I can move on to the thing that I really want to do. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that is hope. For example, sometimes you might need to take on all manner of projects in your office in order for you to create a good relationship with your superiors so that you can actually end up picking up the stuff that you want, cherry pick the stuff that you want. If you walked into an office and tell your boss, oh, boss, I'll get involved in that particular project and I want to sit in this particular team or in this particular group or assignment, your superiors might say, no, I will decide what I'd like you to do because I have a bird's eye view of the entire organization. Mm. Whereas if you become a valuable member of staff to the point where your superiors feel that, hey, I actually would like to keep this person happy, so I'd come to you and say, Frida, what do you want? I'll give you whatever you want. You had to do the mundane stuff first in order for you to reach that stage where people want to do something for you. Mm. That's really what hope is. At that point, when you're doing the mundane stuff, you can connect with the emotion that good stuff is coming, and I'm willing to wait for that, you know, and I'm hopeful about that. There are other things that you can actually do to create hope in your life. Some people, like, for example, I give you my example. I spend a lot of time traveling. In a year, I perhaps try and book about 6-8 holidays. I try and go somewhere every 6 weeks. And people tell me, like, wow, you have a lot of money. No, actually, I have a lot of money because I do that.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
Yeah.
I don't do that because I have a lot of money. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get flummoxed when I say that. I say, because I take that 4 or 5 days or 5 days or a week or whatever off, that recharges me every single time that I can come back and work for another 6 weeks.
Right. I know I'm going to earn enough in the next 6 weeks to go for that holiday.
That's right. That's right. So that motivates me as well. So that's, I think, the definition. I think that's perhaps the difference between mojo and hope. The 15 drivers, the Australian Business Council.
Australian Business Council,
University of Sydney. I don't have all the 15 drivers with me right now. The first one is, as I said, the quality of workplace relationships. The second one is the quality of leadership that's provided. The third one is having a say. The fourth one is values. If your values and your organization's values are incongruent, you will find it very hard to work there. The fifth one is safety.
Leave it aside. Yeah.
Safety, for example, is not whether the fan, the roof is going to fall in your
you
head.
You won't fall off the chair.
Yeah, no, we're not talking about that.
Which has known to happen in the office.
But it's emotional safety. More than
and
you can find this online. If you go, what makes an excellent workplace, and you Google
Australian Business Council,
you'll get the research paper.
The 15 drivers, right?
Yeah.
There is another question, and this is from Ashwin Nathan, and he says, I'm always told to keep dreaming big, which I do. Mm-hmm. But am I missing out on the smaller, more achievable dreams along the way?
Yes, I think what we need to do, Ashwin, is I understand your question. I don't think these two things are separate. You know, I don't think this dream big and the dream small. All of us need to dream big in the sense that we need an overarching ambition. You know, have something big, something which is wild, something which kind of, you know, Bob Proctor said that if you know how success, but in his opinion, after 60 years of researching people, Proctor said, and some of these things sometimes always sound a bit hokey, sound a bit cliched, right? But some of these things, even though they're cliched, there's a kind of a core of truth in what these sentiments kind of convey. First one is this. If you dream about something, and if it's so big, if you have a goal which is huge, a huge, huge goal, the goal must both frighten you and excite you at the same time. Frighten you because you have no idea how you're going to get there. Right, that must kind of freak you out a little bit, excite you because it is so great that if you actually achieve it, you have done everything that you want. You know, and so what I think a lot of people fail sometimes to do is they get connected with these big goals, these huge things, right? And then they plow away and then they plod along and carry on and carry on and carry on, but at the end they forget to take these little, you know, because in order for you to get to that big victory, there'll be many little tiny things that you do, and you successfully need to navigate through step 1 2 3 4 in order to get to step 40, where the big goal
before you get to Hawaii, you need to go Bali first.
Absolutely. Or you know that before you need to go to Hawaii, let's say it's Hawaii, you have a couple of options. From Kuala Lumpur, there's no direct flight to Hawaii. Right, not that I know of. Right, so you will have to fly to another destination, maybe one or two destinations, and you might say, "I want to spend all my money in Hawaii." So what I will do is I'll find the cheapest flight. So what you can actually do is fly from Kuala Lumpur
to Osaka
first on Air Asia to Osaka, and then you stop in Osaka, you take a break, and you reward yourself because you've got to Osaka, and Osaka is one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
It is.
All right, and then you may continue with Hawaii, or you might come back first and then go, okay, no man, Hawaii can wait. No, so I come back, I earn more money now. So next time I fly back to Osaka, this time I don't have to wait in Osaka. But what I will do is I'll fly to some other destination first, and then I will, and eventually I'll get to Hawaii. I mean, there's a long-winded way of saying that along the way, what we need to do is we need to be able to take our big goals, break it down into smaller goals, right? Take our big ambition, break it down into smaller ambitions, little steps. And every time we achieve those little steps, enjoy that whole process and enjoy the beauty of doing it. No? So that's what I would suggest.
Joseph Tan from Leadonomics came on air and he was talking about what is perseverance. It's struggle plus hope. It's when struggle without hope, and that's desperation, or you know, but then with struggle and hope, there's equals to perseverance. And if you any questions, you can WhatsApp us at 0162019000, tweet us at BFM Radio. You can post your questions on our BFM Enterprise Facebook page live. Very cute. Rob Kayser, he's tweeted, said, Austin Powers didn't coin mojo. Listen to LA Woman by the Doors. Well, I'm sure, right?
But we stand corrected. Thanks.
You stand corrected, but, you know, Austin Powers did it very cutely.
He did it with style.
All right.
Lost my mojo, man.
Can you give us a real-life example of a hopeful story?
Many, many stories. There are many, many people that I know, I work with, the people I come into contact with in all the iterations of my life. About how hope fuels people. But some time ago, I spent some time with a very young comedian called Dilruk Jayasena. This guy called Dilruk, originally from Sri Lanka. Dilruk went to Australia to study accounting about 12, 13 years ago. Along the way, he qualified and started working as an accountant, securing a job. So I think the degree was about 4 or 5 years in total, getting professionally qualified. And so over the last 7 or 8 years, he's been working as an accountant. But as he was working as an accountant, he started flirting with stand-up comedy. I think he enjoyed the idea of stand-up comedy. Now, I met him first about 2.5, 3 years ago. 3 years ago when I was on a scouting mission to Melbourne to look out for stand-up comedians for the Crackhouse Comedy Club, which I co-founded. At the time, he was about 2-3 years into this experiment with comedy. So he had his normal day job as an accountant. So it's a very interesting thing. Frida, it's really interesting to actually have a day job, and not just a normal day job, but a day job which is extremely challenging. Being an accountant is it's arguably the most mundane job in the world, right? And to do that, and then to go out and work as a stand-up comedian in the evening, and also
it's very different personalities as an accountant and also, a comedian. Huh?
You know, this is the other thing. Like even with me, Ryan, I co-founded and co-owned the Crackhouse Comedy Club, and sometimes when I'm there and I've never done a stand-up comedy routine. I don't think I have the discipline to write and to do, you know, maybe I have the skill. I don't know. But what I've done is I've done hosting of shows sometimes, right? And I enjoy doing it, enjoy the banter with the crowd and all that. But every time I'm there, also, I'm acutely conscious that professionally this doesn't go well for me, you know, because I'm a consultant and I'm a management consultant, blah, 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 all of this leadership coach. I don't want people to think I'm a bit of a joke when I'm doing this.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So I separate.
Right?
So in order for you to be an accountant and then still go and do stand-up comedy in the evening and not get affected by it and think that, you know, this is fine because this is an alternative career path that I'm nurturing takes a lot, firstly. Mm-hmm. So he dabbled. And so I liked him, you know. So I invited him to Malaysia to come in, not be a headliner. So in 2015, I got him to come to KL, and we gave him one show here in KL, and we gave him something else to do, a couple of other bit parts here and there. But he wasn't the main event, but he was an accompaniment, you know. So he was like the opener or the second act or something like that. It was all right. He went back. Now, you know, fast forward a year later, we had an opening. Somebody dropped out. Mm. We had an opening for a full headliner slot, and we were trying around night. I hope Dilruk doesn't feel that as a last resort I came to him. But he knows I came to him quite desperately, and I said, dude, like, you know, can you fly in from Melbourne? I have, you know, we have like a, we can't find anyone. And he cleared his dates, and he said, sure, I'll come. He came, he did this two-day headliner spot this time. Approximately a year since the first time he came, I was completely blown away. In that
1 year,
12 months, he had gone from good to great. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Literally gone from good to great. You know? From being a good kind of, you know, solid performer, he became this guy who could just take the room, you know, 100 people and just turn them around and do a full 35-40 minute set and have people. So after the show, he was staying with me. So I had a little chat with him and we got on talking, and I told him, I'm really very proud of you. You know, and it sounds a bit condescending.
Like but, a proud father.
Yeah, but I felt a bit like, you know, oh, wow, you know, this is nice. And I feel so, you know, proud because I'm part of your growth trajectory, you know, by bringing you, giving you international gigs and so on. Right? And he said something really interesting. He cast his mind back to the 2 years before, not the year when he came, but the year before when I first met him, before when I first booked him. He said, 2 years ago, he said, when you spoke to me, you said, you know, in about a year, you'll bring me over to Malaysia to do some, you know, bit parts.
Yeah.
At that time, I knew I wasn't good enough. I knew I wasn't good enough, right? But I said, I would love to come. I didn't say I won't. I said, I will. And he said, I said that because I knew I had absolutely no doubt in my mind that I was going to become better.
Mm. Is right.
It, you know, and that is what being hopeful actually means.
I know I'll get better.
Yeah, I'm not good, but I know I'll get better. So many people get defeated, you know. So many, many people get defeated by themselves because they think, I'm not good enough.
Right.
And then they declare that they declare to all and sundry that they're not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the problem.
Well, thanks for being with us again. Just a note here from R. Suresh. He said, great Shankar. I love the show and your MU trips.
Thank you, Suresh.
Shankar Santoro from EQTD Consulting will be here for the third Friday of next month in our Success Consciousness series. You've been listening to Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.